Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin, the moment you come into view.
Chances are you might be familiar with both this song and the person who made it famous. Johnny Mathis emerged from a humble upbringing in San Francisco to record his first song in 1955, and he has never left the public stage since. Mathis, along with names like Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett, have provided the romantic soundtrack to life around the world for generations.
Billboard magazine lists him as the number 6 selling album artist of all time. Mathis continues to record new music and perform for audiences, including the crowd that will gather at the Riverside Theater on Friday night. We had the great pleasure of speaking with Johnny Mathis from his home ahead of that show. Johnny Mathis, it is a great honor to speak with you.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much.
Well, so I wanted to start in a strange place because I have known your music for a long time, but I don't think I knew until I started preparing for this interview that before you were a famous singer, you were a champion high jumper. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, kids like in school do a lot of crazy stuff, and I did, of course. I got involved in politics. I was the president of the student body, but I was a high jumper and a hurdler on the track team, and my big claim to fame was that I had an outside chance of making the Olympics as a high jumper. But during that the week that I was to try to qualify for the Olympics, I got a chance to make my first recording in New York. So instead of going to the trials for the Olympics, I went to the trials for my career, and fortunately, everything worked out.
Well, right. These were both fields that there are no guarantees. Did music seem like the more secure option for you?
Oh, my goodness. My dad was right there with me all the time and says, well, son, we'll give it a shot. We'll see what happens. Anyway, good things happened, and that's that.
Well, good things really did happen. You mentioned your dad, and I was also reading that the first piano your family owned, that your dad actually had to disassemble it and then reassemble it to get it in the front door?
Our apartment that we lived in, I lived in it with my 6 brothers and sisters, and there were always a couple of relatives who were migrating from the South to San Francisco who were staying with us. And let's see, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rooms and about 12 people. And my dad showed up at the house one day with a bunch of wood or sticks or something and put it together, and it became a piano. And we all heard my dad play the piano for the first time. We had no idea. But when he was a kid, he was a singer and played the piano. So that was the beginning of my career. My dad was my best pal, always. I have a lot of wonderful memories of my dad and how we started out and what he used to tell me. Come on, son, let's try this. Let's go over here and sing for this. Maybe somebody will hear you. Fortunately, somebody heard me.
You signed your first recording contract with Columbia in, I think it was 1955. Do you have any recollection of the expectations that the label had from you then?
Well, I was signed to Columbia Records by the head of jazz. His name was George Avakian, a dear, dear man who just recently passed away. He was almost 100 years old.
Wow.
But he was in the head of jazz, and he thought that perhaps he heard me sing in a jazz club in San Francisco when I was 17 or 18 years old. And said he'd come back, and sure enough, he was true to his word. He came back the next year, heard me sing at the age of 19, took me to New York, where I made my first recording, which jazz-orientated with a lot of very famous jazz musicians, John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet, Gil Evans, Manny Album, all sorts of wonderful jazzers. And I did my best, you know, to keep up with them, but it wasn't until I started working with Mitch Miller that I really found my niche, and that was singing popular songs of the day.
at what point did you maybe figure out, you know, did you start to have an inkling of what songs might be a hit?
Never. The first single recordings that I made were It's Not For Me To Say, When Sunny Gets Blue, a song called Warm and Tender by a new songwriter, Burt Bacharach. Nobody had ever heard of him. And one other one called Wonderful, Wonderful.
Sometimes we walk hand in hand by the sea, and we breathe in the cool, salty air. You turn to me with a kiss in your eyes, and my heart feels a thrill beyond compare.
I went into the studio and recorded those four songs and never heard them again until about, 6 or 8 months later. I was wandering around New York all by myself and I had to take a taxi somewhere. And lo and behold, as I was riding in the taxi, my song came on the radio, first time I'd ever heard it, and I almost wrecked the taxi, telling him to stop and listen to my song. And that was the first time I had gotten any inkling about what kind of feeling it was to have a successful career, yeah.
Suddenly you had gone from just somebody who was trying to make it as a recording artist to somebody that everyone would know.
Well, I am completely overwhelmed by the success that I've had over the years. But fortunately, I wasn't blindsided by it. I had started to take voice lessons when I was about 13 years old from a woman who gave me voice lessons free of charge. She was quite good at what she did. And fortunately, I learned enough about voice production to not injure my vocal cords, which is a big deal. And over the years, her kindness to me, because she taught me free of charge, has paid off. I've had minor little occurrences once in a while when I've sung a little bit too much. But other than that, all of her tutoring and all of her knowledge about vocal production really was the basis of my career.
And along those lines, can you talk about what you do to get your voice ready for a concert today?
I don't talk. Yeah, the only thing you can do, really, is to save your voice. Don't talk. Well, you know, say yes, no, that's about it. And make sure you keep yourself 110% ready to sing. It requires a lot of maintenance, good physical habits. You want to keep yourself strong because you're supporting your vocal qualities from your diaphragm, and it's nice to have a nice, firm belly, which is something that stuck in my mind from the time I was a little kid, and I've been going to the gym now. This is about my 60th or 70th year.
Wow.
Of exercise routines. I exercise about 5 days a week all the time, yeah.
Probably not high jumping, though.
Well, no. I had two hip replacements over the years, but I did go out one day on the golf course with one of my singing buddies, and I said, what's this all about? And, of course, I certainly found out about it, and now my big passion, other than singing, is golf.
Now, maybe this is a strange question, but maybe not. As I was getting ready for this interview, I was remembering a scene from a movie called Diner back in the early 1980s. The movie was actually set in 1959. And in the scene, there are two characters debating who the best singer was to make out to, Sinatra or Mathis.
You know the thing about Sinatra? He's good, but he's too thin. I don't like that.
Yeah, but you can't compare them. Sinatra is the Lord, all right? He's big in movies, he's big in nightclubs, he's big...
Skip that. Let me ask you another question. Scott, when you want to make out, who do you make out to? Sinatra or Mathis?
That's a stupid question.
One question, answer that.
It's irrelevant, I won't answer it. Mathis.
What about you, Shreve? I'm married, we don't make out.
Do you think at all about the fact that there are generations of people who think of you as the soundtrack to their teenage dating life?
I never did. I just sang. And then somebody said, well, it always sounds romantic, what you sing. I said, yeah, but I sing a lot of stuff. I sing the Cold Deidre. I sing Ailey Ailey. You know, I sing jazzy stuff. And they said, no, no, no. Everybody thinks about you as a romantic singer. And I said, well, I used to talk to my dad about it. He said, well, son, maybe that's not so bad. And I guess he was right.
Is there a secret to being a nice guy in a field? You know, the recording industry is not always so nice to its talents. Is there a secret to being a nice guy in a field that is not always so nice?
I think it has a lot to do with your beginnings in whatever business or whatever social situation you get yourself involved with. But you must remember, I've had a lot of help along the way. I've had a lot of people who have counseled me about what would be the best way to go about my career, a personality which you must keep a low profile about, because there's so many challenges from day to day to day in a situation like I'm involved in. And all of it is just a very natural occurrence of what happens when you're raised by someone like my dad and my mom. And I have a very quiet way about doing whatever I do, but I have so much help. There's so many elements involved in just getting one person like myself into a career as I've had. And I've had so many extraordinarily wise people to help me along the way, and I can't think of anything other than that which has kept me very grounded.
As you say, you grew up in San Francisco. Even in the 1950s, I gather, San Francisco was a fairly progressive place, especially when it came to, say, racial attitudes. Can you talk about how things were different as you left home?
The thing about growing up in San Francisco was that at a very early age, I was influenced by, for instance, in school, I became president of the student body. I took classes in opera from the vocal teachers at San Francisco State College. I went to the opera in San Francisco. They had a wonderful opera company. I also frequented all the jazz clubs that my brothers and sisters took me to, because there were so many extraordinary clubs where all the people from all over the world came. And then there were Broadway shows that came through San Francisco. There were nightclubs that a young person, even when I was not of an age to go into a nightclub, when people would say, oh, that's okay, you know, he's grounded, he can stay here, he doesn't have to drink, he can listen to the performers and what have you. And all of that added to the fact that at a very early age, I was influenced and I heard some of the greatest singers, musicians in the world come through San Francisco. And I felt comfortable learning from all of the occasions that I had. And from the time I was about 12 or 13 years old, I met some of these people. And they remembered me when I started to sing. People like Lena Horne, Billy Eckstein, Louis Armstrong, they all came through San Francisco lots of times. And my dad took me to see them, and occasionally I'd get to say hello to them, and my dad, of course, would say, my son's a singer, you know. And they always remembered that. I remember so many of the, especially Billy Eckstein. He said, oh, John, your dad drives me crazy talking about my son sings too. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me to spend my youth in San Francisco. It was immeasurable, absolutely.
There must have been some challenges for you as you were performing before the country changed the way it has.
Yeah, from the time I was 18 and started to travel, went to New York, and of course, after I made my initial recordings, the record company wanted me to go out and find jobs so that I could sing and let the people hear me. And some of these occasions took me to the south of the country. And, you know, there were all sorts of unhappy situations where I got into merely because of my color, not because of my singing. But it was embarrassing from a worldly person like me coming from San Francisco to go to places where you were denied simply because of the color of your skin. And I was a young kid. This is ridiculous, but of course, that's all a part of the world. I learned how to handle it. I learned mostly to go to where I was going to be safe, because there were instances when it became dangerous. People threatened me in the South. They wrote me terrible letters, don't come back here anymore. And I had no idea why they were doing that. But all I knew is that, that wasn't much fun, so I won't go there anymore. And that's what happens. But yeah, on the whole, because I had success at an earlier time, I could choose and pick the places where I wanted to go. And at a very early age, I went to Europe. And it was an eye-opener. I had a lot of success in Great Britain with my recordings. And over the years, I've gone back and back and back and had a lot of success with Christmas music over there.
For someone who has performed as many concerts over the years as you have and has recorded as many albums over the years as you have, what makes you happiest today about your life and music?
I'm happiest because I'm surrounded by musicians who are friends of mine, and those are the people that I am in contact with day and night, night and day, all of the time. I have my guitar player, Gil Rigers, for instance. This is his 40th year working with me. My conductor is 30 years. My bass player, 25 years. My drummer, 30 years. And we're pals. And we go all over the world, and we bounce off each other. Each one of us has different responsibilities and different backgrounds in music. And so we are really a family. And that is what absolutely makes it an enjoyment experience. I don't have to deal with a lot of things that I don't know anything about. All I have to do is make sure that I'm ready to perform. And I know that I am blessed in this way, because that isn't always the case with the people who do what I do and have to travel as often and as extensively as I do. But I'm a very, very lucky person.
Well, Johnny Mathis, it has been really rewarding to get to chat with you. I'm so thrilled that we had a chance to talk.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much.
Johnny Mathis recorded his first single in 1955, his first album in 1956, and 78 more albums since then. Just last month, his 1982 album, I Love My Lady, was released for the first time on vinyl for Record Store Day. Mathis plays the show Friday night at the Riverside Theater, and there's a link to more information at WUWM.com.
Life is a song worth singing.